Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining me in studio I have Dr. Anthony O'Connor, consultant gastroenterologist at Talla Hospital, Paul Donnelly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin West, Anne Rabbitt, Fianna Fáil TD for Galway East, Sandra Scanlon, lecturer in American History in the School of History in UCD, and Gary Murphy, head of the School of Law and Government in DCU. And we'll be joined later by Dr. Maeve O'Rourke from the Irish Centre of Human Rights at NUI Galway. Now, a second case of COVID-19 has been confirmed in Ireland tonight. It concerns a woman in the east of Ireland. Here is Dr. the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Holohan, speaking at the National Public Health Emergency Team briefing just before 9 o'clock this evening.
Today, we're confirming that Ireland has diagnosed one new case of COVID-19. The case arises in a female in the east of the country and is associated with travel from northern Italy. We have now 397 people in total who have been tested as of Monday, the 2nd of March, yesterday evening.
And that was Tony Holohan, Dr. Tony Holohan. And here's Dr. Ronan Glenn, who is his Deputy Chief Medical Officer. He was asked about what are the next steps now in terms of establishing contacts of this woman who has now been diagnosed with COVID-19.
We've only been notified in very recently, this evening. So the contact tracing process has begun, and that starts with an interview with the case and identifying the contacts, and then public health will communicate with the contacts and issue appropriate advice. So that process has now begun.
So there we have it. The process has now begun in terms of establishing the contacts of this second case. Anthony O'Connor, did I see on Twitter that you did your doctoral thesis on infection? And
Helicobacter pylori, an infection of the stomach, yeah, but a microbiological theme, I suppose.
What do you make of how we are handling this at this stage?
I suppose, first of all, it's important to note that somebody tonight has gotten very challenging news for them, and they've got a family and friends who may be listening in on the way home from hospitals. And I think it's important to stress that, you know, the care that that person gets in hospital is going to be of the absolute highest rank, and that we absolutely wish all of them a speedy recovery. I think, obviously, it's a concerning situation. There's a lot of things that we don't know about this virus, and that's why it's scary. And there's no point in beating around the bush. It is a scary situation. Let's get that out there. There's a lot we don't know about it. We don't have a vaccine for this. There is a worry that this could become established in humans. At the same time, it is important to keep things in perspective as well. We have two cases, both of them picked up the virus outside the state in endemic areas.
That is very important to state. Nobody has caught the virus from anybody else in this country as of this moment.
And that's extremely important, yeah.
Okay, and the other thing that's important, I think, to stress is that this is a virus that, from what we know and what we've seen coming out of China and elsewhere, if you are not compromised, if your immune system isn't compromised, if you're not elderly, if you're not pregnant, though all those issues that might make you more vulnerable, if you don't fall into that cohort, you are likely to hardly know you have this virus.
For most people, it would manifest itself as a mild illness. But again, there is much that we don't know about it. Most young people who are getting it, children in particular, seem to make a very good recovery from it. The younger people who have struggled with it in China have tended to be healthcare workers, unfortunately, which is a big cause for concern for me and people like me who work in our hospitals. Certainly it does seem to be that the people who are in the greatest at risk group and the people we've the most concern for are the elderly, those with coexisting medical conditions and immunocompromised patients. Mm.
That decision that was announced at that briefing this evening to move testing from hospitals into the community, Tony Holohan seemed to be suggesting that it would be ambulance personnel that would end up doing the testing. Do you think that's a good move?
I think my understanding is Tony Holohan and Ronan Glynn have been very much on top of this and have been working extremely hard and have an escalation plan in place. And the data that they have is telling them that this is the next logical step. So I trust that. Certainly our ambulance personnel to Ireland are trained to an extremely high standard. And I would have full confidence in carrying out testing to every bit as high standard as it would be done in a hospital or elsewhere in the community.
You'd wonder though, don't you, about the stress and strain you put on. What we know is a very stretched service at the moment, the ambulance service, and we've been told 397 people have been tested so far. Presumably the numbers of people who will be requesting testing will increase perhaps exponentially as these things go on. Would you have a concern that this might be putting too much on the ambulance service.
My biggest concern in this whole thing is the strain that it'll put on an already under pressure health service. And I think what we need to do now is remain calm and sensible and think, what are the things that we can do as a country? Because this is a national situation. I won't call it a crisis because, you know, it isn't but yet. But this is a national situation. And, you know, the political side of things, education, healthcare, the media, we need to all come together and see what are the things that we can calmly plan on doing now in the next couple of weeks. So as if we do get badly hit by this virus in the coming weeks or months, and that is a possibility, that we're in as strong a position as we can to handle it.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the information flow and the role of the media and all of this. Gary Murphy, obviously we had that issue with the school that is at the centre of the very first confirmed case, and the instruction from the department and the government that the media was not to name that school. Now, some media did not go along with that instruction. They did put the school out there. But of course, the school was, anyone that had a phone in their hand could find out who the school was. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think it's a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't type of situation, really. I understand the HSE view, and Tony Holohan expressed very eloquently, I thought, in terms of privacy for the patient, I suppose. But also, if the worries that someone else would get, it would not then identify themselves to the HSE or to the health service on the grounds that you don't want to have hordes of, with all due respect to yourself, Katie, journalists, rooting around in whatever suburb or estate or farm one would live in. And at the same time, we do know, of course, because of the extraordinary power of social media, the name of this school pretty much straight away. So there's a balance to be struck. I obviously agree with Anthony in that I think the HSC seems to be doing everything it can do to contain what clearly could well be a panic situation. You see hand sanitizers being sold out and the like, which is always, it always kind of worries me when you see sort of extreme reactions. But so I tend to think that Tony Holohan, I don't know, but he seems extremely impressive and authoritative. And I think the best thing the public could do is probably trust the professionals. As Anthony says, we have world-class people in a system that is creaking. And that's the only thing that would obviously concern me. But yeah.
Anne Rabbitt, I mean, there was a fairly big backlash from the public when they realised they weren't being officially told what the school was, even though, as you say, the school became fairly public knowledge quite quickly. I just wonder, like, is that the hill that the HSE and the Department of Health should die on, as in trying to keep confidential something that quite plainly was unkeepable confidential? There was no way that was going to be maintained as a secret. Yeah. So I'm just thinking, in terms of building trust, do you just acknowledge there are some pieces of information that simply will not be contained, and take control of that information rather than driving people perhaps to social media where they're going to find out all sorts of other things that may not actually be accurate?
See, there's two sides to it, Katie. That's the way I would look at it. There's two sides to it. And I think the HSE were trying to set boundaries on Sunday night and trying to keep calm within it all.
But it was an unkeepable boundary.
It was. But if you were looking at it from the other point of view, imagine if it was a school in East Galway that is a two-teacher school and there was only 10 kids within it. Very clearly, very quickly, we would identify who that child was within it, who had come back from a trip. So I could see the balance as to why they were trying to protect the school and the identity of the child concerned, or the teacher, whoever it is, the male within the school. So there was two sides of it. And I thought, Ciara, there was a response on Twitter there that says, no, you're not entitled to that information. Patients are entitled to their privacy, and nobody should be going on national airways.
This is not a private health matter, though. This is a public health matter.
Totally. It is a public health matter. And that's why communication in all of this is critical. And if this, and it's like I was listening to his interview this evening, or his announcement this evening about the second case of it. And he says, I'm following the same protocol as I followed on Sunday evening. And he clearly outlined that we have a female in the east. He wasn't identifying whether it's in Dublin or where it is, but you could think it was anywhere from Louth all the way down to Wicklow, but they're following the same protocol. So they've started the way they mean to go on. They will keep us informed, is my understanding of it, and they're going to keep communication flowing.
Yeah, you see, I just, the first text that came in on this is moving testing out of hospitals just another way of keeping the facts hidden from the public. Openness and transparency would build far better trust amongst the public, says Jerry in Dublin. Paul Donnelly, yeah, your party leader made a video and put a video out referring to the because telling us that her children were in this school that, that had been targeted. Was that a good idea?
Look, I think by that stage, I think everybody in the country had known exactly where the school was. I mean, on the Sunday, I had known by 5 o'clock exactly where it was and exactly where this school was. So at that stage, it was very clearly known what the school was, where the school was. And again, I think it's really important. We have to, I suppose, in some ways, listen to the experts and try and reassure people that, you know, that this is being dealt with, that we have the capacity to deal with this. At the same time, we sometimes do have to challenge and, you know, try and work our way through this situation because, you know, I don't think there would have been any harm in saying that there was a person who was in Dublin and you used the region and instead of the east, because I'm sure there was people from Belfast all the way down to Wexford who are figuring out, going, God, I have a bit of a sore throat here, or a bit of a cough or a sniffle. Was it in my area? So there, it's a very, very difficult. I wouldn't like to be the person who was making that decision as to where it would be. But I do think it's important that, you know, we certainly, I think the HCI, hope they are looking at how we manage this one, because I have a real, real concern. We have a creaking system. We have a system, particularly an A&E system, which is really, really in serious trouble. And we know this every winter. We
perhaps
see this happening.
That's why they're using the ambulance service to ensure that we don't have people coming in, whether they have it or they haven't it.
Sure.
And trying to protect the most vulnerable who are already within the HSE and protect the workers and everything else. But at the same time, equip up our ambulance drivers, our medics, paramedics that are going out.
But there,
and
there
I
are
think
people,
that's the plan.
There are people who are really, really worried. And I suppose they're worried for a number of reasons. I've had dozens of messages from people going, look, I work in this particular employment, I have no sick pay.
That is the human. So we're going to get guidelines, as I understand it, tomorrow in relation to the public.
But I mean, that's the first thing that I thought of. There were so many people who are in employment. I think it's 2 million people who are in employment where there's no sick pay scheme. And since the recession we had now, where originally it was 3 days, where you got 3 days, and then after 3 days you could claim, it's now moved to 6 days. So people are saying, what am I going to do for a week? And if I'm earning X amount of money, and then the second week where I self-isolate...
And I suppose force majeure is there as well. And we can't forget that...
Well, it is. That's only 3 days for most employees.
With 3 to 5 days in a 5 days in a three-week period.
It depends where you work.
It does depend where
you work.
A lot of people would be very slow to turn around to their boss and ask for their force majeure.
But also as well, would a doctor give you a sick certificate by saying, look, I'm actually perfectly healthy, but I have to self-isolate? Does that get a sick note? Does that qualify for the Department of Social Protection?
If you actually have to see somebody, the current rules are you have to see somebody, and that's what's not being advised. So to me, the solution would seem to be, you know, if the state calls you up for jury duty, there are arrangements made that you can't lose your job and you get paid and things like that. I think if somebody is asked to self-isolate by the health authorities, that they should be able to avail of the same benefits. I think they're providing the state in that instance with every bit as much of a service as somebody who's attending for jury duty. So I think that'd be
a big issue for the health service has to be all the agency personnel, the nurses and the doctors that, and we rely so much, as we know, on on agency medics now. And they're on the front line, as you say, that from other places where this has been a bigger issue, we know that they have, you know, become infected. So that must be a big issue. And is there, do you know if there's any contingency plans in place for those kind of...
There are contingency plans in place around staffing and infrastructure, but
even for agency staffing.
Yes. But you know, in terms of how well equipped we'll be, we simply don't know. We don't know what the extent of this is going to be. And that's
no, but I'm saying in terms of if I'm an agency nurse and I am told I have to self-isolate, am I going to get paid for my?
Oh, sorry. Yes. I think we'll have to. I don't know. Will they be covered by the public sector arrangements that are going to be announced tomorrow?
You see, there's an awful lot of these hypotheticals.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty big hypothetical.
No, exactly. But that's just the problem with hypotheticals. Yeah. You know, you can just take them to all sorts of extremes. And I think this is why it's really important that all of us do obey, to use that word, the advice we're getting from the HSE.
I don't think it's a hypothetical, though. It's not a hypothetical at the moment. There are people who are being asked to self-isolate.
No, but I just mean Katie's particular example of agency nursing. You know, that was my point. Because you can bring hypotheticals, you know, to all sorts of extremes. And I think that, just to reiterate, that's why we need to take cognizance of what the HSC, who are the experts, are telling us. And my understanding, I'm sure Anthony will verify, is they are following what is best practice internationally. We've all these like people on Twitter who seem to know better than the health experts, and that's what we need to avoid.
For me, the last thing we want is somebody who's on a low wage, one paycheck away from losing their house, and we know they're all over the country.
Who's afraid to come forward
and self-isolate because they'll lose their job, won't be able to pay the rent. And, you know, I think, you know, politically, medically, everything, we have to move quickly on that one, I think.
If in Talla there was a number of cases and people, severe cases that would need ICU, need your ICU unit, how would you cope with that in Talla today?
So the HPSC have issued very good guidelines for hospitals as to how they should cope with that. So if a couple of cases were in the ICU of a particular hospital, what would happen would be what would normally be the ICU of that hospital would then move out to the operating theatre and elective operations would be cancelled, which will obviously have a big knock-on effect on a number of people. But that's the sort of protocols that most hospitals are working under at the moment. But there's all sorts of knock-ons from that. If elective surgeries are cancelled, if clinics are cancelled, it will cause huge disruption, obviously, but this is a situation we may find ourselves in.
Okay, can I just listen now to what Professor John Oxford, who is the UK's top expert on virology, had to say on the Sean O'Rourke show this morning.
I think you have to take it a bit more seriously, I must say. I've been to many myself, St Patrick's Day parades around the country. Well, first of all, they are around the country, it's not just Dublin. I go to one in Macroom. So every little place has a parade. If I were in their shoes, I would say, I think we'll postpone it. It's not the end of the world. Take advantage of the situation you're in, and I would go ahead and stop the parades, I must say.
Now, Tony Holland saying this evening that he saw no reason why, as things stand, that the St Patrick's Day Festival should not go ahead. Of course, we're going to get more guidelines tomorrow in relation to this. What's our feeling on this?
Professor Oxford's advice is interesting, but he does come from a different perspective. He's not a public health doctor, he's a virologist, okay? So, you know, when someone like Tony Holland is making that decision, they have to think of all the possible outcomes. So if the issue is that we've got, you know, 20,000 people arriving into Ireland for the St Patrick's Day Festival and we call off the parade, they're still going to come to Ireland. And they're not going to sit in their hotel rooms with towels over their heads. They're going to be out and about. They may be in pubs and restaurants in close proximity to people. So, you know, Tony Holohan and his team have to think of all that. Well, what's going to happen?
But surely that was the same for the rugby. Yeah. I mean, Italians were going to come to town anyway.
And we're hearing today that 5,000 Italian people are intending to travel anyway. So, you know, none of these decisions are easy. So, as Gary said earlier, in some respects, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. The judgment call that has been made at the moment is that the parade will go ahead, and maybe a decision has been made that you're better off having people out in the open air.
Wasn't the rugby a confined issue? Wasn't the rugby a confined space issue? Well, they said it was a mass gathering, but in a confined space where we assume now the 5,000 Italians will wander to all parts of the city and beyond.
We did cancel the St Patrick's Day parade
in 2001. We could well cancel it again. We could see the Six Nations games cancelled next week. Who knows? I agree with Paul. I wouldn't like to be in these shoes.
20,000 Irish people are going to go to Anfield and Old Trafford and White Hart Lane and everything this weekend. And as we know, they're melting pots for people from all over the world. So, you know, there's only so much you can do.
And we have to think about the tourism sector as well. Like, I was going to say, yeah, that's an effect that it's going to have. And that's why calmness is awful important at this moment in time, because there's a lot of business who depend on the St. Patrick's Day parade. And that's probably the start of the season that brings us all the way through to the end next September, to be honest with you. And in 2001, I worked in a bank, and our directive was to actually be a little bit more tolerant and more flexible with the extension of the overdrafts to ensure that they had the working means because of the repayment capacity. And the same with revenue should be the Department of Revenue in relation to VAT returns and everything else, that we should look at how we supported the industry in 2001. And like, no different to what we're saying a few minutes ago, that sort of
forward thinking needs to be put in place.
The more you hear about this, the more you think this is going to cost a fortune.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is going not just in the hit to the economy, possibly, but in just in terms of managing all of these issues that we've been talking about. Will we have a government that will be managing it, though, Gary? Will this push us into or push the various parties into actually talking to each other in a serious way rather than just faffing around with policy documents?
Well, I think it should. I mean, like they always say, you know, you sort of live the last election. And I think that's what's happening in post-election formation. The fact that it took 74 days the last time seems to have given the parties some sort of luxury that, yeah, we can go 74 days this time or give or take. You know, you heard a lot of talk about Easter, which is another, you know, 35 days away or whatever, which seems ludicrous in my view. I mean, today there was a softening of the Sinn Féin, Fine Gael view, where they said that they were happy to talk to everybody. That certainly was different to what the Taoiseach was saying in the immediate aftermath, where he said he wouldn't talk to Sinn Féin. Now he says he will talk to them but won't form a government with them. I mean, I don't think we're quite in national government territory, but I do think they need to get a move on all this policy positions, you know, and Sinn Féin talking to the Greens and Fianna Fáil talking to the Greens and Fine Gael talking to the Greens. You know, there are two possibilities. Fianna Fáil move and go with Sinn Féin and the Greens, or Fianna Fáil don't move and Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens get together with some independents. These are the two options, and the sooner Micheál Martin makes up his mind, I think the better.
Paul?
Look, I mean,
Are you delighted that Leo Varadkar wants to talk to you now?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think it's a very strange way that he's operating at the moment. I mean, he writes an article, which I think was an absolutely disgraceful article, on Sunday, and then proclaims he's sending a letter to talk to Mary Lou. So
case people didn't read the Sunday Independent, that article referred to Sinn Féin as...
Well, I think he was looking for Cab and the
Guards. Even beyond your means.
As I said to someone the other day, if Cab want to investigate me, I'm sure they'll write a reference to the banks for me in relation to me. I think that stuff...
Do you get any sense that things are going to speed up there? Do you get any sense?
No, I don't. I genuinely don't. And I'm a bit frustrated because, you know, on the one hand, you've got Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael both saying that they're not going to be talking to Sinn Féin. Sometimes maybe talking to Sinn Féin, sometimes not, and then pulling back again. Then coming out with some absolutely outrageous stuff in relation to our party. Look, at the end of the day, it's Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the Green Party who are looking, from what I can see, to drag this out for as long as they possibly can. And then possibly go into some sort of government at the end of it. We're still moving forward and trying to put forward some sort of left alternative.
Anne Rabbitt, you're dragging this out for as long as you can the inevitable has to happen.
First of all, you've ruled out talking to him. Micheál Martin was, I think he can be as clear as day.
And you know what? You ran an entire campaign saying vote anything but Fianna Fáil. You ran an entire campaign saying vote left because we're not going to do business with Fianna Fáil.
Ran an entire campaign saying you wouldn't put Fine Gael back into government.
And I ran an entire campaign trying to get elected and lucky to do it by 137 votes. And delighted to be able to do it.
If you're going to talk about people going back on what they said during the campaign, you're on pretty dicey ground yourself there.
Right. But anyways, moving on. We have met with the Greens. Moving on. We met with the Greens last week and we had 2 days with them. We're meeting with Fine Gael tomorrow in policy documents. We're meeting then Thursday then back in again with the Greens. We're trying to find a common ground because at the end of the day...
Are people coming up to you, Anne Robin, and say, would you just get on with it? Just do it because, you know, there's too much going on here for you to be faffing around with.
They know we're not faffing around. They know we're actually trying to form a government. They know that Fianna Fáil have decided to step forward. Our objective is to make Micheál Martin a Taoiseach, and our objective also is to try and come together with the numbers that when we go in before the Dáil the next day that we actually can actually form a government.
Okay, I want to move on. I want to go to Marion McKeown and talk about Super Tuesday. But Sandra, just before we leave the COVID-19 story, the handling of this in the States and what's happening and how President Trump is framing this is really interesting, isn't it?
Well, a lot of this has to do with the fact that it's an election year, and obviously everything for the president in this year is about politics. So yes, he's framed this initially as a hoax put forward by the Democrats in terms of the scale of it, that they're exaggerating the scale of it in order to benefit from this politically. I think they've rolled back from that, in fairness, in the last week, and really recognised with what the CDC is saying in Atlanta that, you know, this has to be taken more seriously. So there's a clear plan in place now to deal with this, but the way that the president has framed it initially was obviously around the issue that this is a political year. Everything is politics in a presidential campaign. And he is seen at this point as not handling it terribly well and is concerned about the idea that this is going to go back to the way that President Bush and his handling of Katrina really reflected so badly on him. So when you've got any kind of national disaster, the implications of that to really very rapidly turn a president's popularity can really be quite extreme. And that was his initial concern. We know with Trump, it's always about popularity. So that was his initial reaction to it. I think it's now been taken out of his hands and he's recognising he's probably not the best person.
And it's now in the hands of that great, renowned scientist.
Vice President Pence.
Yes, indeed. OK, let's go to the States now, because, of course, it is Super Tuesday, the single biggest day in the race to choose the Democratic presidential candidate. A third of all delegates in the Democratic presidential race will be doled out when voting ends across 14 states. I'm joined, if you wanted to put on your headphones there, because I am joined on the line now by Marion McKeown, the US correspondent with the Business Post. Good evening, Marion.
Good evening, Katie. How are you?
We're very well. We're dying to hear what's happening over there. The voting is underway, but we won't know the results until tomorrow.
I'm afraid you'll have to wait another minute, Katie, for the results. Vermont should be in the next hour or two. That's Bernie Sanders' state. I can confidently predict and read the tea leaves that Bernie Sanders is going to win Vermont. But some of the states like California, it could be days or even longer before the results come in. A combination of, they're not very good at counting votes in California. Also, you can vote right, if you post in your vote, you can post it right up until today and it will still be counted even 3 or 4 days' time. So there, as I say, there are a couple of things. There'll be a lot of early votes as well, though. Very fast moving, this story at the moment. Joe Biden, I think I spoke with some of the Sanders people earlier on today. I think they were caught a bit off guard by how quickly the moderate Democrats rallied around Biden. Buttigieg pulled out of the race. So did Amy Klobuchar. They immediately endorsed Biden. Beto O'Rourke endorsed Biden in Texas then as well. Tom Steyer is gone. Not that he was ever really in it, to be quite honest. But you now have a four-way race. We've gone from 27 to 4. And it is Joe Biden, it's Bernie Sanders, it's Michael Bloomberg, and it's Elizabeth Warren. Now, Elizabeth Warren and Michael Bloomberg are the two unknown factors. I think that Bernie Sanders will do pretty well overall today. He'll do well in California. He'll do well in Texas. They're the big, big states. So just to give you a very quick example, California has, I think, 415 delegates in total. Vermont has only 16. So you see the span there in the amount, the wealth of the different states when it comes to delegates. Texas, second biggest state, has 228, where Sanders had been really doing well until the last day or two, when it seemed like Biden might be catching up. But then there are a lot of other states. There are Bible Belt states today as well, Katie. So states like Arkansas, Oklahoma, Alabama, even North Carolina, none of those states will go with Bernie Sanders. I can tell you that. They all think socialism, get me out of here. They would be very much Biden states, I would imagine. But now that also Amy Klobuchar is out of the race, some people might think, well, let's coalesce around Elizabeth Warren here. Let's give her a go. And she's not doing too badly in California. But the big caveat is you've got to get 15% of the vote. If you don't get 15%, you get no delegates. Now, people have been saying for decades, could the Democrats make this any more bloody complicated than they do? Probably not. But so I'm not sure if I've just confused you more now or if I've brought any clarity to it whatsoever.
Okay, let's go back through them. So Joe Biden, as we say, there was people writing him off up to last week. He seems to be a bit of a comeback kid in this and very strong, of course, with African-American voters. So what does he need to do to stay in this race, Marion?
Okay, Biden's big problem all along has been two things: no money and very little enthusiasm. And you know, North Carolina did bring him. I beg your pardon, South Carolina did bring him back from the brink, and I mean really the brink, in that he did get about half the vote, and he got 61% of African Americans. But you know, I've been saying this, Katie, to put it in context, it's good compared to where he was, but it ain't that great compared to where he needs to be. Hillary Clinton in 2016 got 74% of the vote in the South Carolina primary. She got 86% of the black vote. You know, so if you see the comparison there, but Biden at the moment, look, a lot of the Democrats, I'd say about half the party, is desperate to stop Bernie Sanders, and they will take anyone but Bernie. Now, a couple of days ago, they were talking about Mike Bloomberg, and yeah, no, he might be a good president for us. He might do well. They don't like Sanders. They didn't like him before this. They certainly don't like him now. So what Biden needs to do is, he's not a great campaigner. Honestly, I've been to a lot of his events. They're very downbeat. He doesn't have natural enthusiasm behind him. I see him as being a bit like a John Kerry in 2004. I think he would really struggle to beat Trump if he were, you know, if he became the candidate. So I think he needs to up his game on a number of ways. But I still am not convinced that it's going to be him. Of course, you'll be saying to me in a couple of months you were wrong, but I don't really see Biden going the distance. However, we'll wait and see.
Okay, stay with us there on the line, Marion, because I want to bring in Sandra Scanlon. Sandra, of course, lecturer in American history in the School of History in UCD. Would you go along with what Marion was saying there in terms of Biden's chances?
I think it's hard to know. I mean, I remember being asked 4 years ago whether or not who was going to win the election. This was July 2016. And I said, well, it all depends on the campaign. And everybody in studio said, you're crazy. It's of course, it's going to be Hillary Clinton. And that's what all the pollsters said. And it wasn't. It's very difficult to know at this point. To be honest with you, the situation, as Marion has said, has changed so radically in the last week. Biden has come up enormously, given where he was a week ago. I think the enthusiasm factor is an issue there, but there's so much. I just came back from living in the US for 2.5 years. There's so much anxiety about Trump amongst Democratic voters. There's so much goodwill to just get him out that I think that anybody, quite frankly, who is a Democratic candidate, even if it is Sanders, is going to get a huge amount of support from the Democratic base. The problem is,
will
the
they even if it's Sanders? Because yes, this whole idea that he's not even a Democrat, why are we supporting him?
But he's not Trump. And I think the reality is that his talk of revolution is also not real. And most people know that he's not going to be able to get through the things that he claims he's going to be able to get through. He's almost certainly, if he is at the top of the ticket, that's not going to benefit people in terms of the Senate and congressional campaign. So he's going to face a Republican House potentially, and certainly a Republican Senate. So the situation is not going to be a revolution if he becomes the candidate. The issue is whether or not he can get crossover votes from, say, suburban Republicans who are frustrated with Trump, but not so frustrated with him that they're going to vote for Sanders. Those people may potentially vote for Biden. I think he does have that crossover support, as we mentioned, Marion mentioned, in places in the South, in the Midwest, if he's got people like Klobuchar and so forth behind him. He has the potential to get places like Michigan, who, again, didn't go for Clinton last time because people just didn't vote, where it's a very different situation this time.
The two unknowns, as Marion was saying to us there, mm-hmm. are Bloomberg and Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
What's your sense of both? Of course, nobody really knows mm-hmm. until we see these 14 states
that Warren will be out within the next couple of weeks. We know that one of the PAC that is supporting her, for instance, has only just announced it's not planning to run television ads over the next week for next week's primaries, which is a very strong sign that they're really pulling back from support for her.
And Bloomberg, Gary.
Yeah, I mean, he in one way is the great unknown. He has such a vast amount of money that he can afford to stay in, unlike Elizabeth Warren, who really isn't that much of an unknown, of course, and a wild card. I mean, I lived in the States last semester in the University of Notre Dame, and she was all over the debates and doing very well.
But she is very impressive in those debate formats, isn't she?
The attraction sometimes doesn't go with you, you know, and sometimes when...
They don't like women, do they?
Well, there's certainly a little bit of that. And of course, they went with a woman the last time, Hillary Clinton, and they lost. They're cognizant of that. I disagree with Marion slightly in the context that I certainly think, and I agree with Sandra, the Democratic Party will rally around Biden. They mightn't rally around Sanders as much, but of course then there's the famous Ralph Nader effect. We know what happened there. A couple of million people voted for him and put George Bush in the White House way back in 2000. But at the end of the day, Katie, you're looking at maybe 8 states. You know, we know who, no matter who the Democratic candidate will be, they're going to win the West Coast, they're going to win the Northeast, they're going to win in Illinois. And we're looking, Florida will probably go for Trump, but it's Wisconsin, it's Michigan, it's Ohio, it's, you know, they're the states. There's 7 or 8 of them, North Carolina. So Virginia, and yeah, so that's what we're looking at even this far out, I think.
Marion, ultimately, I suppose a lot of people, as Sandra was saying, there are this huge issue around Trump and the idea that he must be stopped one way or another. So the question must be, who is most likely to beat Trump? And there doesn't seem to be an answer to that right now.
Well, I think one of the things that we should stress as well is that Trump's support hasn't just grown wider, it's grown deeper. Trump supporters are fanatical and they will turn out. They turn out 3 days ahead of his rallies to make sure they get in the front row. They will turn out to vote. And in elections, it's all about turnout. So you can guarantee that at least 36-38% of the electors will turn out and they will vote for Trump. I'm not sure that Joe Biden, and I know everybody's saying, yes, they want to beat Trump, but I'm not sure he will get that kind of turnout. Now, I want to go back to Mike Bloomberg because I don't think Elizabeth Warren can do it. I think she can stay in the race a little bit longer. I think she might surprise people tomorrow, but I don't think she's got the money behind her or the momentum at the moment. Mike Bloomberg's an interesting case because one of the big things at the moment is the coronavirus in the States. And I was listening earlier, and one of your people there
did
say very correctly that Trump Sandra, I beg your pardon, Sandra, sorry, didn't handle it very well. And she's absolutely right. Now, if this gets bigger, I think people are going to start looking at somebody who has experience as an executive and who has experience in handling crises. Mike Bloomberg came in. I was living in New York when 9/11 happened. He was voted in very shortly after that. He took over when New York was really in a state of chaos after 9/11. He was there through the bioterrorist attacks, which the anthrax, all those things. He was very calm, very steady. And then he also was there, of course, during the big crash of 2008 and stayed on, got an extra term. He's good at managing crises. He's a good executive manager. Not the most exciting candidate in the world. Terrible debater. But people might start wanting something apart, you know, changing from the Trump where he's bouncing around. He's trying to bounce people into saying what he wants about vaccines and all kinds of things. And people don't really believe him. I think that Americans, if they think that the economy. I've been talking to people in New York who say there's nobody going to the theatre in New York at the moment, there's nobody on the subway, that people are really staying at home. That's the kind of thing that starts a recession. So I think that the coronavirus could be the big unknown here, but there are 9 deaths now and about 100 cases. It may stabilise now. That might be the peak. It may not. It may get much worse. But I would factor that in for somebody like Bloomberg who may not have had much of a chance otherwise. You know, and as your people there have said, he can afford to stay in this race. He can, you know, $500 million. He spent that already, $500 million. He probably makes that in interest in a week or month.
I was going to say he has plenty of money to sustain the campaign.
Plenty of money. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Marion, I'll let you go. Thank you for that fascinating analysis, as always. We'll no doubt talk to you again before this race is run. Anne Rabbit, just watching you engaging there with that chat. Have you an interest in American politics?
I would have a little bit. I wouldn't get up in the morning, but I would be. I always like the underdog sort of a situation. So, like, I would be watching Bloomberg myself personally.
I'll say Bernie Sanders there.
I don't know if Mike Bloomberg used to be called the underdog in any circumstances.
No, but in this one, he sort of is because he doesn't have that debating skills or anything else like that, and they just think that he's going to just throw the money at it and get there. In actual fact, it probably will be his management skills that got him so rich in the beginning that will actually come into play if that crisis starts to unfold. People like solid pair of hands to get the job done because he's a proven track record.
I suppose the thing, I mean, Ireland generally tends to go Democrat, don't we, in terms of our attitude towards American politics.
Generally, yeah.
Paul,
I just find it incredible to think that that Bloomberg, a multi-billionaire, would be an underdog because they're spending half a billion on ads alone. I think is quite credible. But yeah, I think most people would. I mean, personally, I would like to see Sanders get in there and give it a go. I think there's an opportunity there. I think because you're saying that the Trump people are so motivated mm-hmm. that they will kill. I think there'll be a lot of people on the flip side who would be also so motivated. They'll be energized. They'll have a ground campaign that they really need to motivate people to go against Trump. I'm glad I don't gamble, because if I did, I would have never predicted Trump. I'd have mm-hmm. never predicted Brexit, and I wouldn't have predicted Johnson. So it's all out the campaign. And I think as it gets closer and closer and closer to November, we have no idea what way America mm-hmm. will be talking or thinking in relation to what their new president will be. So
it's Sandra.
It's very interesting.
The room is there for Sanders to win. Mm-hmm. I just don't think there's any room for him to achieve what he's promising. And he's an extremely divisive candidate who's more than likely going to simply plunge, not him personally, but this is going to plunge the US into even greater political division, which is the last thing that American politics really needs.
But isn't he doing something very interesting, though, as well, mm-hmm. in terms of he's running this big ground campaign, this campaign of the people, small donations, not the big donors. Mm-hmm. Very unusual in American politics.
Well, it's following on from what Obama did.
For the first time in 2008. So it has been...
There was big donors behind Obama in a way that they're not behind Sanders.
But those big donors didn't really come in until he started mm-hmm. getting traction and ahead of Hillary Clinton around this time, sort of Super Tuesday on March, April of 2008. The big problem, I think, for Sanders does remain that he's not even a Democrat. I mean, he still is not a registered Democrat, mm-hmm. as far as I understand. He is an independent who was latched onto the sort of Democratic ticket. I still think the... And we saw when O'Rourke, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, when they've all come, like the whole of the Democratic sort of structure is against him. And I think he'll find it difficult to find a path to win in July.
So if you were going to call it, you'd
I think Biden will win the nomination in some way. And I think mm-hmm. Biden has a good chance. I think Bernie Sanders will be like, Sandra will know this as a history, be like George McGovern in 1972, could go down to a historic defeat.
Mm-hmm. And if Biden wins the nomination, can he beat Trump in the election?
Again, I'm not predicting anything because it's no point, as we've heard. Anything could happen. As Marion mentioned with coronavirus, the truth is that things can flip very quickly. And certainly what Trump has been riding on recently is the fact that the economy is so strong. And there's very real potential for this to undermine the economy. And we heard about people in this country being concerned about losing pay and everything else if they can't work. I mean, the situation in the US is much more extreme. You can't go to the hospital if you're ill because you can't afford it and so forth. So this is going to have an extreme impact on people's sense of security. Whether or not that leads them to go with someone like Sanders is going to be a surprise. We'll see. But to be honest with you, I think this will come down to the convention we're going to have, but very likely a contested convention for the first time in decades in July. And Sanders may well get the majority of votes on the, so not the majority, but plurality of votes on the first vote, but he's not going to. I would be very surprised if the Democratic machine doesn't rally around to support an alternative candidate on the second or third vote, so that it will not be Sanders getting a nomination.
And just before we leave this, do you have any view on how the Americans are dealing with the coronavirus, Anthony? Have you been watching it?
From listening to Gary and Sandra, it'd be easier for me to predict how coronavirus is going to pan out. I used to live in the same street as Elizabeth Warren when I lived in America, so that's. But in terms of how the Americans are handling it, it's interesting that the company that's involved in the outbreak in Washington State is a company called LifeCare, and they're no stranger to the controversy. They were involved in the Hurricane Katrina controversy at Memorial Hospital there. So I think, you know, the motivation with which healthcare is delivered in the United States is different to how it's delivered here. That's as somebody who has practiced in both places. And I think I would be worried about the effect that's going to have on how they handle coronavirus.
Mm-hmm. And if people are going to come forward for testing in those circumstances. Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm going to have to take a break there. I think you're going to leave us, Anthony O'Connor, even. Thank you for your contribution tonight. But we want to stay with us because we're going to talk about redress breaking the silence after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, 20 years ago, Mary Raftery's landmark States of Fear programme rolled back the stone on institutional abuse. And now, two decades later, RTÉ have revisited the victims for its two-part documentary by Moya Carney and Mick Pilo, Redress: Breaking the Silence, revealed the background and the hard reality of the official response to states of fear, and outlined the compromise that meant that no abusers would be held to account and victims would feel further abused by the system put in place by the state. Here are some voices from part one of that documentary, beginning with abuse survivor Michael O'Brien.
I thought I was in the Supreme Court in Dublin. There were so many barristers and solicitors there questioning me. I don't believe you, Mr. O'Brien. You didn't. I don't believe that you were sexually abused. I cried like the rain coming home. I would have went in under the biggest truck that was passing had Mary not been in the car.
You're talking about the last cabinet meeting. This is something, by the way, that has been negotiated. It's in the best interest of everybody. Bring it to closure. And that's how it got through. And in retrospect, in my view, that was a mistake at the time.
How did this come about that the church and state actually produce a system that is abusive all over again?
And that was Mary Lodato ending those clips from part one of Redress: Breaking the Silence, which aired last night. We've been joined now by Dr. Maeve O'Rourke, lecturer at the Irish Centre for Human Rights at NUI Galway. And of course, someone who we know on this programme has done a huge amount of work vindicating the rights of victims of institutional abuse. And Maeve, you were watching part two while we were on air this evening. Like what I saw of it before we came down, so powerful, so disturbing still all these years later.
Yeah, it's true. And we heard more this evening of the ins and outs of the redress board and the real sense of being re-traumatised in a completely unnecessary way, in my view, given that that was actually never making findings. Again, like the Ryan Commission, explicitly in the redress board legislation, it said that there any award was not a finding of abuse. And yet, survivors were subjected to the most traumatising experiences. We also heard more about lack of access to records, and incredibly importantly, we heard quite a lot about the ongoing needs of survivors of industrial and reformatory schools.
Yeah, just at the very top of that documentary this evening, part two, there was that really shocking story of Joseph Pike, young boy who was beaten by the Christian Brothers. They've acknowledged that a beating did take place and was died 3 days later, the Christian Brothers saying that his death was not connected with the beating, but his memory being kept alive by one of his colleagues from that school, a boy who was, you know, he's taken this with him for decades. And I think it is the abuse that has carried on through the generations is really the striking sense you get from this.
Yeah, I think it teaches us a lot, and we really need to stop and think about this carefully, about the absolutely lifelong impact of torture and of, as we're now coming to understand more about, adverse childhood experience. I mean, this programme, it just can't be a blip, and it does require us to think about how we act today, how we act today in respect of the survivors of our so-called historical abuses. And let's not forget, we have survivors, so many of them out there, people who never went to the redress board, people who are in no fit state to participate in a programme like that, who really are struggling and totally marginalised, survivors of all the other institutions, survivors of the adoption system. And so we have so many people to think about, but we also need to think about what we are doing today to children, how we are failing them, and how the impact of adverse childhood experience and torture, which this absolutely was in industrial and reformatory schools, lives on to the very end of survivors' lives and absolutely has an impact for generations after that.
Yeah. In relation to this programme, this two-part documentary focused hugely on the reaction, the state reaction. So there was the inquiry, and then there was the redress board and what happened there. And really, I suppose we have known, because we've, over the years, we've heard accounts and we've heard a lot of unhappiness with how the redress board operated. But just to have it all put in perspective, and they pieced together how that inquiry came about, how the indemnity was given to the religious orders. Anne Rabbitt, we heard there Micheál Martin, who was, of course, a member of the cabinet at that time. I think he was the Minister for Children at the time. Am I right in that?
The education.
No, it was Michael Woods was the Minister for Education who would have done.
Health.
Oh, he was in health. He was in health, exactly. And he acknowledging there in that documentary that how that was done. There was a collective cabinet decision to support that indemnity deal for the religious orders, and he said that is a mistake. But it is a mistake that had huge implications for so many people, because it wasn't just about the money that we didn't get as a state from the religious orders, but it was the total lack of accountability that order, that government decision.
And to be fair, like, you have to acknowledge Micheál has come clearly out and said it was a mistake and it was wrong. And I suppose there was a lack of awareness as well, or a lack of expertise within that cabinet, of an understanding about how the process would take place, to be quite honest with you. Because when you look at that programme last night and you hear how people are re-traumatised and what they were expected to relive every last piece of information and to tell it all again, and some hadn't even probably shared some of the information with their families, and here they were standing in court, like a court setting is what one of the number of them said, was just like a court setting. They felt totally they didn't feel equipped going into it. They felt that the whole armour of the state was against them, and they just felt they were lucky to hold it together. And that man, as he said, only for the wife was in the car with him. He wasn't in a good space after leaving it. He felt he was re-shattered yet again. And that's what these people, and we have to compliment them for coming out and doing this, because it will open the minds of an awful lot of other peoples in relation to when people talk about historical cases and everything else and retrospective cases and how people come forward to tell their story, how we treat these people and how we have to understand that for them to tell their story, they have to relive it over again. And the emotional effect and the mental well-being of them, it is just complete. We can't understand it, but it's a completely shattering moment for them.
Gary Pat Lee of the Irish Times was in the programme last night saying that he felt this was one of the worst ever decisions by a government.
He was quite right. I mean, with the bank guarantee scheme, they're the two that stand out to me. And what do they have all the hallmarks of? Oh, it'll be OK. It'll be all right on the night type of thing. I mean, just because it was the last meeting of that term is no excuse to railroad through a decision that we would have no idea. You mentioned the cost. That's bad enough. But then the idea of the state's duty towards these people brushed away for what was it? What they thought would be half, and is now not, you know, it's a drop in the ocean in comparison. The Washington Post has been running a phrase since Trump became president: democracy dies in darkness. And it's true here in this case. We should open all the records in relation to this whole scheme. That's the only way we can get to the bottom of things in relation to survivors of abuse, but also in relation to the state itself. And I think Pat Lee was quite emotional, I thought, during the thing. Most of what I've seen him is very dispassionate normally, but I think he was quite right. And he's right to also find about cabinet responsibility, because that's why we do have 15 members of cabinet to say, well, what are you doing? And I thought Micheál, although he was right, but also Bertie Ahern was rather casual, I thought, saying he didn't understand why Mary Laffoy had resigned as the chair of the commission, and he seemed to couldn't understand it, where she had made perfectly clear at the time and again in the documentary why she did.
Yeah, Mary Laffoy making very clear in the documentary that
there was resistance
from the Department of Education in terms of access to records. And we are still having rows about records.
We absolutely are. So, I mean, the programme's really important in that it's that milestone 20 years later, but it isn't actually telling us anything new. And unfortunately, these are absolutely ongoing issues. So the current Mother and Baby Homes Commission is not giving access to a single document that it is considering, not even records of deceased babies to their relatives who cannot find them. So I think we have the issues of accountability ongoing, and there's a real need, in my view, and in the view of a lot of survivors, practitioners and academics, that we need a national archive of historical care-related records where people can access their own files, where they are entitled to deposit testimony, and where we can access, as a nation, administrative files. But there's also the ongoing, very real concrete needs. And I actually think survivors need to be put in charge of those. The Department of Education at the moment is the department that is in charge of looking after the needs of survivors, of consulting with them over what we know are their very real housing needs, education needs, the fact that they are terrified of being institutionalised in nursing homes because they can't access home care. I don't think the Department of Education is unfortunately the right department to be doing this. And I think survivors, perhaps as an ombudsman or some kind of independent commissioner who are survivors, need to be established to deal with these ongoing needs, because it's more than industrial schools and reformatory schools victims as well.
And that issue about records, because towards the end of the lifespan of the last government, we had this row over this bid to seal records for 75 years.
Department of Education.
It's outrageous. Like, it's 75 years.
To me, that is it's flabbergasted. But it was being resisted. But where are we with that now, Maeve? Is that still on the cards?
It's in no way gone away. I think Senator Lynn Ruan did an amazing job, along with some other colleagues, on the All-Party Education Committee at the point where it came to Dáil committee stage. In fact, the whole education, both parties committee got together, and they actually for the first time held a hearing that listened to survivors. Can you imagine? It had got to that point by the Department of Education without actually consulting survivors as to what they wanted to happen to their records.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to leave this here, but we will have you back again, Maeve, because I do think this is a story that has to be told over and over again until survivors get what they deserve. We'll take a break there.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannon on RTE Radio 1.
And I'm afraid that's all we have time for tonight. I want to thank my panel for coming in to me tonight. I want to thank you all for listening. Tonight's programme was produced by Regina Hendley. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Nikki Dempsey was on sound. And now I hand you over to Colm Murray on Late Date.